Hi, this is Dan Lynch. Join me and Aaron Newcomb for Floss Weekly as we talk to Thomas Pearl, the developer of GPodder, and also GPodder.net, which is a web service. They're podcast subscription services, and you can use GPodder.net to subscribe to all your stuff and share your subscriptions. We're going to talk about it next, so don't miss it. Come and join us.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 272, recorded Wednesday, the 6th of November, 2013. GPodder. Hello and welcome to another edition of Floss Weekly, the show about free Libre open source software. I am your host for this week. My name is Dan Lynch and I'm coming to you from Liverpool in the UK, way far over there, over the Atlantic, away from the Twitch studio, but still coming in hopefully loud and clear. I'm joined by Aaron Newcomb, who's our co-host for today. Aaron, how are you doing?
Good. How are you, Dan? Long time no see.
It has been a while. Yeah, it's been a little while. And now Randall's away. I should have said at the top, Randall's away this week. He's on a cruise. So while the cat's away, the mice will play, as they say, and we're in and we're back and stuff. So, yeah, how's it going, Aaron? What have you been up to? Anything exciting happening in your world right now?
Not much. You know, I've really busy with work at NetApp and doing that kind of stuff. So, yeah, not a whole lot. Just doing a lot of Twitch shows and having a good time.
Okay. I've been actually having to play with a little project with the Raspberry Pi lately, which I know you're very into the maker culture. So I've been trying to make an Icecast streaming box, a client, if you like, for Icecast streaming. So it works at the moment, but it's not very exciting looking. It's just a Raspberry Pi with some cables coming out. I'm thinking maybe a nice box would be good with some lights on top. And I really want to get a VU light meter that would tell me the audio level, but I don't know if I'm quite at that level yet. But hopefully one day we'll have my own little bespoke made audio streaming box, preferably with a big button on the top that I can just press for go and stop.
Awesome. Yeah, you should definitely, next time we do this show, or maybe after the show, we can, in the outtakes, when you get it up and running, we can demo it, see how it works. That'd be great.
Yeah, that would be very cool. So we could try an Icecast. I could actually broadcast the audio over Icecast. Anyway,
there you go.
We're getting sidetracked. But we're not here to talk about Icecast today, unfortunately, but we are here to talk about podcasts and podcast clients, in fact. Because we're going to talk about a project called GPodder, which is a open source podcast client, or podcatcher, if you prefer that term. It's been going for a few years now. I happen to know the developer, Thomas, who we're going to speak to today, which is good. So I have lots of questions prepared for him. So Aaron, have you heard of GPodder? Have you looked at it at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I've used it in the past on Linux distribution. So I haven't used it in a while, though. I do most of my podcatching, I guess is the correct word, on my phone, my Android phone. So I'm curious to see if this works on Android. I hope it does.
Yeah, that is a very, very interesting subject, which I'm sure we'll get into. I'm much like you. I used to use GPodder on my Linux desktop, and then I started doing everything through my phone, which is an Android phone. So sadly, I kind of moved away, but maybe Thomas can convince us to move back today. So we should go ahead and bring on our guest anyway. Thomas, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you well.
Excellent. So we're talking to, I just realized I didn't give you a full introduction there. So we're talking to Thomas Pearl, who is the lead developer of GPodder. And where are you talking to us from, Thomas?
From Vienna in Austria.
Oh, Vienna. Beautiful, right. I'm tempted to sing, "Oh, Vienna," but you probably don't want to hear that. Whatever it is, Ultravox. GPodder is a podcast client and all the rest of it. And I realized I didn't do the full intro there. So, it's a podcast client. This project's been going for a few years, but you can probably far more accurately tell us about it. So tell us, if you can, the kind of the 30,000-foot view, as Randall calls it, of what GPodder is and where it came from, if you can.
Yeah, so GPodder is an application to download podcasts, as you already mentioned. In recent years, it also gained support for downloading videos and audio from different sources. Like, for example, if you want to subscribe to something that's not available as a podcast, but available as, for example, a SoundCloud user, you can subscribe to that as well. It has been available initially for the Linux desktop, but has since been added to There's a Windows version available, and there is a macOS version available, and there's some mobile versions available as well.
Excellent. Now, I suppose we could get straight into Aaron's kind of opening question there. I was going to leave this a bit later on, but I know there was a lot of demand for an Android version. So you have an Android version now, that's right?
Not really. I mean, there are some experimental ports. You could build it yourself and run it on Android, but you would have to root your device and install Python manually. So it's not that easy for end users. There's no APK you can download yet. It might come in the future, but it's not so much a target for me personally right now. But the code is available. It does run on Android if you're doing some porting work. So if anybody's interested, they are free to go and port it.
Do you get that question a lot? Because I imagine you probably do get people asking where the Android version is. Is there any kind of demand for that, do you think?
Yeah, I do think so. So I get this question all the time. Like, is there an Android version for that? Especially since there has been a mobile version for Cheapwater before, and there still is, like for MIMO and MIGO. But obviously there are not so many devices for that platform out there. So while Cheapwater runs on these platforms, now that people move to other platforms such as Android, they demand a version of Cheapwater for Android. But as I said, it's not really my target, and it's quite hard to do because porting to, for example, MIGO is quite easy from the Linux desktop, but porting to Android is a bit of a more difficult situation there, especially for applications that are written in Python.
Yeah, I was just wondering about that because I've not really tried running much Python stuff on an Android device, but I've heard it can be quite difficult. So we should probably mention, obviously, it is written in Python. We've kind of given that away. But can you tell us a bit why you decided to write it in Python? Was there a reason that you thought Python would be good for this kind of thing?
Yeah, so initially when I started the project in 2005, all I knew back then was, I think, C and Java. So like the really first version was written in Java. But then I quickly figured out that if I wanted to do a Linux desktop application, writing it in Java is probably not such a good idea because Java wasn't available in Linux distributions back then. So you had to download it manually. So then I decided to go with Python because it was easily available from the repositories and it looked quite easy to use.
And was this one of your first major kind of open source projects? Was it just a little thing you decided to start for yourself, or how's it grown over the years?
Yeah, so it was, I think, my first open source project as such. I started in May 2005, just writing an application, pushing a source out back then at SourceForge, I think. And I think it took 1 or 2 years until it really got traction and picked up as a really open source project and getting outside contributions. So it took quite a while, but now it's quite a nice project and there are many contributors there.
Well, that kind of brings us on to something we usually talk about later, but we may as well get into it now. But what's the community like? You've got quite a few people committing code now. Is there a GitHub repo, or how do you manage all that?
Yeah, so right now we're using GitHub, and we have different repos. So there's one for the normal client, but we have also different things like in a web service, which we might talk about later. So we are now splitting up all the source into different repos. So the podcast parse is going to be a separate Python project that other people can use as well. We have the Cheapwater core now, which is just all the core functionality like managing subscriptions, parsing feeds, managing downloads, stuff like that. And then now on top of that, we are building different UIs. So for example, there's a QML UI that's going to be used for BlackBerry and Sailfish OS and so on. There's the command line UI, which is in the core itself. And there might be other UIs in the future, like for example, a GTK 3 UI for GNOME 3 or something like that.
And I noticed you mentioned QML there, which kind of piqued my interest because I know the Ubuntu phone platform, Ubuntu Touch, is going to use QML, I believe. Is that something that would interest you, getting it onto Ubuntu Touch devices as well?
Yeah, so it should be quite easy to do. So all we need for the QML UI is Qt 5, which Ubuntu phone already has. So the only thing that's needed there is the Python bindings, which is just a very small module. Either maybe Ubuntu supplies that as part of their platform, or otherwise we could just package it with the app as well.
And we kind of got into talking about mobile versions already, and you mentioned that you had a MAMO, an Amigo version. And just for anyone who's watching, a very quick kind of potted history of what's going on here, if you've got no idea, I once had an N900, which was a Nokia phone that they released with an operating system called MAMO, which was basically, I would describe it as Debian on a phone, if you're familiar with Debian. You could apt-get packages, which is incredible on a phone. You know, that for a geek, that's like the ultimate cool. Thomas was already developing for that. I think the N800 and the N770 and other things as well. So how come you got onto that? Did you just have one of those devices and you like the look of the platform?
Yeah, so actually it started out by... So MIMO, the 770 and the N800 had the UI was basically based on GTK. There were some modifications to the widgets, and these modifications were called Hilden. So actually, it turned out that some community person got the GPorter source code and ported it over to MIMO. So in, I think, late 2007 or something like that, we were actually getting bug reports in the official GPorter bug tracker for the MIMO version, which I didn't know anything about at that point. So in early 2008, I got myself N800 and actually started porting the upstream version to the N800 and got started from there. So the fact that it used GTK made it really easy for me to just port it over to that platform.
I had a N800 myself and I loved it. It was a great little device. I didn't use it as much as I would have liked, but especially for watching videos and doing things with media, I thought it was an exceptional device. It worked really, really well. It was kind of like before all of the smartphones, it was kind of like a smartphone in and of itself. It was without the phone functionality. And then later, of course, with the, I think it was the N900 is when they actually got some phone functionality as well. So I'm curious, I saw online the there's a gpotter.net. There's some sort of a web service. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah. So a few years ago, I started trying to make a small web service to collect subscription information from users that actually opted in to push their subscription there. Because the idea was we didn't really have any kind of example subscription or something like that. So the idea was when a user actually downloads GPotter and has no clue which kind of podcast they can subscribe to, they would actually go there and have a list of different kinds of podcasts that they could subscribe to, for example, Floss Weekly. And so it started as a really, really small script, basically, CGI script, that users could opt into to submit their subscription list to, and we did a top list. So we had the list of top subscribers for the podcast, and then we basically created a bigger web service where we not only had a list of subscription, but also things like top lists of episodes, so you could sync the playback status of your different podcasts between devices. And that's something that we actually used. For example, if you had GPotter running on your desktop and you listened to one episode 20 minutes in, then had to go away, you could actually, via the GPotter.net web service, synchronize that playback information and pick up your phone and start listening from the 20 minutes in the podcast there. So right now, GPotter.net is maintained by Stefan, which is a colleague of mine, and he's doing all the kind of web development work. And the GPotter.net web service is also open source, and it's also written in Python.
Wow. So if I wanted to take that and then build my own online service, I could actually go download the code and do that as well.
Yes, exactly. So it's available also on GitHub. The setup might be not that trivial, but the instructions are there. And if you have any questions, you can ask on a GPotter mailing list. It should be easy to set up. But of course, the real benefit of the service is when many people use the same server, or like the main server, because then we can have stuff like top lists, so like top subscriptions of podcasts, top episodes that I listen to, and you can have per episode statistics over the whole user base. Like, for example, how many GPotter users have listened to this episode in the last week or something like that. But of course, because we also value the privacy of all the users, that's totally optional. So if you don't want to use this feature, you can also switch it off.
Does anybody else use the code for their own? I mean, because there's a lot of sites out there like this, right? I mean, do you know of anybody else that has kind of picked up the code and is using it or contributing back?
I don't know of any. I don't think that anybody right now is running the Jupyter.NET source code as such on a server. What I do know is that many people try to integrate with the server and at least use the directory functionality. So because we have so many users that are actually pushing their subscriptions to our web server, we now have a pretty big list of podcasts sorted by different kinds of categories and stuff like that. So different podcast clients and other platforms are using Jupyter.NET to actually do the search and provide the search functionality.
And then what are you using on the back end? Do you use a specific framework to build the site?
We are using Django. And I think right now we are using MongoDB as the database backend.
Nice. I mean, I've got this up right now. I'm just kind of looking at it. I don't know if you mentioned this because I was messing with my audio settings there for a little bit, but it also, you can use it with Amarok. How does that work?
Yeah. So actually, some students from Vienna, they wanted to do a semester project. So we at our university had to do any kind of software engineering project. And there are basically two options. One is you can write like a throwaway application, or the other is you just find some open source project and contribute to that. And also Jupyter.NET started as one of these projects. And some semesters later, another group of Vienna actually did the Amarok integration, which is called libmygpo-qt. So it's actually a Qt library that integrates with Jupyter.NET, and they integrated it with Amarok.
Nice. We should mention, maybe John can bring it up on screen. It's actually pretty, pretty nice little site there. It's got all kinds of directories and services, and like you were saying, you know, popular podcasts and things like that. So it really is pretty cool, and you can register an account online and get set up really, really easily. So. I'm going to start paying more attention to this because I was familiar with Jupyter, but I was not familiar with Jupyter.NET, and this is a really, really cool feature. Now, do you find that this tends to be more bent towards a Linux-y crowd? Like, you know, I'm assuming that the people that know about this are Jupyter users, and hence they're probably open source software users, and so. It seems like maybe the directory and the suggestions here may be, although the Ben Heck Show is here, but again, it seems to be more technical, more open source, Linux-y kind of podcast. Do you find that to be the case?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was even more the case in the beginning when we just did our top list manually, because basically what I put into the suggestions list that people would see when they open up Jupyter and they don't have any podcasts was things like Floss Weekly or, for example, Linux Outlaws.
So I was going to say, Linux Outlaws was in there. I owe you a big thank you for that, for putting that in for us. Yeah, it helped our popularity.
Yeah, so that's something that, I mean, we know that these podcasts are kind of popular, but we didn't know what kind of podcasts our user would listen to. So that's why we also tried to use the service to get a better picture of what our users actually subscribe to, instead of just assuming that everybody would listen to Linux podcasts.
Yeah,
but I think it's definitely true.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's definitely true that right now it's mostly Linux focused, at least for the bigger part of your user base, because even though there are people who use it, for example, on Windows and don't know that much about Floss. I do think that our major user base is usually Linux users.
Yeah. I mean, this could be actually quite useful. I don't know if you're doing this or if you've thought about it, but it could be used for people that want to advertise. I mean, if you're getting this feedback, it seems like it would be a good avenue for advertisers or for us podcasters to say, hey, look, advertisers, here's the popular podcast or my podcast is in this list. Here's how many downloads I'm getting and so forth. How does that all work? How is there a mechanism to report back downloads on the, from the web version? I guess that's eventually going to come back to the publisher, but because they're going to be pulling from their site. But do you collect that kind of information and share it with anybody?
Yeah. So the thing is, again, the users can choose to do that, or they can choose not to do that. By default, if the user creates an account and says that they want to share all the information, what the web service actually gets is also the download data. So the Jupyter client, if you download an episode from the client, it actually sends an event to the Jupyter.NET web service telling that actually I've downloaded this episode. as well as I've played this episode, if you playback it. We right. use that information, for example, to allow you to continue playing your episode from a different computer when you pick it back up. But actually, if you're playing the audio inside the Chipotle client, we also get information from where did you start to play and where did you end to play. And that ends up being available on the server. So if you're a podcast author and you have your podcast in Chipotle.net and you have enough listeners, you can actually ask Stefan to get an account there and log into your own podcast website. Like there's a subscriber area there. And then you can actually see when are your episodes downloaded and even which parts of the episode people listen to. So for example, if they skip all the time the first 20 minutes and only start listening from that, you can actually see that in the information in the page there.
Oh man, that's great. I love the fact too that you can stop. So if I'm on my let's say I had my N900, because we don't support Android. So let's say I've got my N900 and I'm listening, and then and I stop listening, and then I get home, let's say from my commute from work, and then I pick it back up on the desktop. It just picks up right from where you left off. That's an awesome feature. I mean, that's something that not a lot of services offer unless you're on the same device.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we have an open API, so every podcast application can integrate into that. The problem is that right now most podcast applications just integrate with the directory search feature. So even though technically we don't prevent anyone from including that feature in their own client, and we would be happy because then the listening stats would be even more informative. Most developers using the web service as a client actually don't do that yet, but the API is there and it's open, and we would love to get more applications integrated into these features.
Yeah, I think it's a great service that you guys should publicize more to podcasters, because this is this is data that's very difficult to get unless you're using, for example, a web client that captures this data for you. But to have this across a lot of different devices, so like if Twit were to use this, for example, to incorporate this API into an app that runs on a phone, or anybody does, that would be awesome, because then you could see, oh, you know, a lot of people stopped watching after the first 10 minutes, which is something that we already know. If someone's not interested, they're not going to watch that long. But that kind of information could be critical for people that are trying to develop new content. I think it's a great feature. Okay, so I just got the client installed here. And the one thing I'll point out for people that may not know is that it will ask you. I'm installing this on Windows. I'm on Windows right now because we're running Skype for the podcast, and it works better on Windows. But if you're on Windows, it'll prompt you to install Python and PyGTK automatically, which is kind of nice. But people should know, don't be afraid of that. It's just, you know, it's automatically prompting you to install the backend software if it's not already installed, which is a great feature. Does it do that on the Linux versions as well? It's been a while since I installed this on Linux.
On Linux, what you usually have is Chipotle in your distro's repositories. So dependencies like that are usually resolved there automatically. So the metadata of the package in the distribution contains information that we need PyGTK and we need Python. So that's going to be installed. And for most Linux distributions that I know of, chances are you already have Python and PyGTK installed. But yeah, on Linux, it's a bit different. And actually, on Windows, previously we bundled actually Python and PyGTK plus all the theming stuff and what you need for GTK. But it turned out that it made our download really big, and it sometimes caused problems if the user already had Python installed on Windows.
Hmm. I was curious about PyGTK, because you mentioned that you're using PyGTK there. How do you feel about the whole GNOME 3 thing, you know, GNOME 2, the move to GNOME 3 and that? Has that been easy enough for you, developing on top of, say, GTK and so on?
Well, it depends. So the thing is, I really like the GNOME 3 desktop. It's also what I use on Linux when I'm on Linux. For Chipotle right now, for version 3 of Chipotle, we are still using GTK 2 because there are some difficulties porting it to GTK 3. No showstoppers or anything. It's just that no one has sat down and actually ported that and integrated everything. So we're doing some kind of special tricks with GTK 2. That stops us from just porting over to GTK 3. But it's something that we might want to do in the future. With that being said, GTK 2 has some nice theming support if you're using recent versions of GNOME. So it actually looks mostly like a GTK 3 application or GNOME 3 application.
Yeah, and I'm sharing my ignorance a little bit here, but how's the portability on GTK 2? It's been a while. I've forgotten. I'm just wondering, can you run it on Windows? Because I think GTA, that's got nothing to do with it. GTK 3, I think you can run, and certainly QT you can run, and things like WX widgets and so on. Would it make it easier to do cross-platform if you had a different toolkit, or is it still okay with GTK 2?
Yeah, that's one of the points that we had early when we tried to port it to GTK 3, that it didn't really work that well on Windows yet. But comparing GTK and QML, QT, it's actually much easier to port stuff also to Mac OS X with QT than with GTK. And also, once you have getting used to QML, it's really you actually want to use QML and want to use QT to do your UIs.
Hmm. Excellent. So is that's something you're going to look to in the future? Is maybe a whole QML version or something?
Yeah. So actually for the N9, we actually have a fully QML version. And the upcoming Jupyter 4 that splits the core and the UIs is also going to have a Qt 5 QML UI. So that's already in the works. Right now it's more focused towards touch-based user interfaces. But I hope that maybe somebody will step up and create a desktop UI for that.
And since we're talking about underlying technologies behind GPodder, will this run on Python 3 or is it a Python 2 thing? Or how does that work out?
Yeah, good question. So the current versions of GPodder that are released right now are running on Python 2. They theoretically run on Python 3, but things like the GTK bindings. Okay, so let's back a little. So PyGTK 2, the bindings only work with Python 2. And if you want to use Python 3, you actually have to use the new G-Object introspection-based bindings, which work with GTK 3. So there's lots of versions going on here. The upcoming version is going to be Python 3 only. So GPodder 4 is going to be Python 3 only. Lots of version numbers there. Yeah, and I would recommend everybody who does Python programming, if they can, switch to Python 3. And if you're starting a new project, definitely start with Python 3 because Python 2 is going away soon anyway.
Mm. And something I always ask every Python developer when they come on or any person who's even interested in Python is about PyPy, which is one of my favorite projects. Are you familiar with PyPy? Have you looked at it at all?
Yeah, PyPy is a really interesting project. I like it. I've read some of the research papers that the authors of PyPy pushed out. For GPodder itself, it probably doesn't help that much in terms of performance because applications like GPodder are mostly UI-driven. Mm. And especially on mobile platforms, because there is a JIT there, it might be that startup performance as well as memory consumption a bit worse on PyPy. On the other hand, if you're doing things like a physics simulation or like any kind of games, then you can gain lots and lots of performance by using PyPy.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been the big selling point, as far as I can see, is the performance of PyPy. And people who've heard me talk about this on the show before will know, but go and look it up. It's PyPy, PyPy, as in Python, written in Python. All very confusing. It's faster than Python, even though it's written in Python. I don't get it. You can go and have a look, and you're probably far smarter than me, and you'll work it out for yourselves. Just search for PyPy. We talked a bit about the community and stuff. You mentioned that you have other people working on GPodder.net. So how big is the team? Is it just a couple of guys, or is it growing all the time? How does that work?
So I'm not sure. So the team usually varies a bit. We have a few core team members that are contributing regularly. We also did some meetings in person here in Vienna this year because, for example, Stefan, who is doing the GPodder.net web service, or also Bernd, who is doing the extension system, they actually are in Vienna or can come to Vienna easily. So we have some in-person meetings there, but there are also other people that are doing other parts of GPodder, for example. There's Joseph who's doing the iPod synchronization stuff. So if you're on the desktop, you can actually use GPodder to copy all the podcasts to your iPod on Linux. Mm. Yeah, there's, for example, Eric who's doing the macOS 10 port. So there are some people that are regularly contributing. But there's also a bigger team that's constantly changing all the time. So people contribute, and then after a few months, they go and do something else. Or maybe Chipotle works for them, and they don't need to do more patches.
Yeah, I'm interested. You mentioned the iPod and so on, because I'm not an Apple guy. Everyone will probably know that who knows anything about me. So I'm a bit out of touch with the Apple ecosystem. But I remember GTK Pod and some of the other things from years back. But I seem to remember one of the big problems was when they moved to the iPod Touch and some of the other things. They broke all the compatibility with things like GTK Pod. So has there been any problems there with Apple shifting the goalposts on you?
So I stopped using the iPod when I sold my iPod Mini. I think that was in 2008 or 2007, something like that. And after that, the iPod Shuffle came out, and I heard that it's kind of hard because you have to jailbreak it or do some other kinds of things to get it working. But for all the older iPods, what people actually did was use Chipotter, and we also used a library that's the base of GTK Pod. It's called libgpod, and there are Python bindings for it. And we use that for synchronization. As far as I know, that also works with an iPod Touch, for example, if you do jailbreak it. But the problem there is, if you have an iPod Touch, chances are that you might want to use the built-in podcast application there.
Mm. And that brings me to an important question, actually, because, I mean, we've talked a bit. Both Aaron and I actually were saying at the start that we've moved from using, say, a client like this on our desktop or laptop or whatever to just doing it on a mobile device. And that seems to be something that's really happened in the last few years. Everyone seems to be wanting to do this on their phone now or on their mobile device. Has that had an effect on the project? Have you seen people moving from doing this on a computer to doing it on a mobile device? Has that affected your kind of strategy or user base at all, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it with myself. Previously, I've been using it on a desktop, but ever since the N900 and the N9, I've exclusively used Chipotter on my mobile phone and not cared about that much about Chipotter on a desktop. That's also why I didn't have that much interest in getting device synchronization back into Chipotter, although there was really a big user base that still did and does that. So I know of a lot of Chipotter users that were kind of angry because they didn't have device synchronization, like synchronization with iPods or normal MP3 players for a few releases when we switched to Chipotter 3.
Yep. Sorry, I paused there. I was busy typing away on my keyboard. That's very unprofessional. So I was just going to ask, what kind of podcast are you into then? So we're going to put you on the spot. I was going to ask Aaron to ask that one, but now I've stolen the question for myself.
Sorry.
What kind of podcast are you into? And don't feel obliged to say our podcast because we understand.
Yeah, so I don't have that much time to listening to podcasts these days. I think it depends on if you have a commute or not. So I think back in 2005, I was still going to school by bus. And I had like maybe even 2 hours per day listening to podcasts. So there was a lot of time to fill with listening to podcasts. I don't have that now. So I only listen to podcasts like a few minutes a day or something like that. Podcasts I listen to or am subscribed to are things like the Moth podcast. You guys know that?
The Moth?
Yeah. The Moth, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a good one.
I thought you said Myth at first. I was thinking of Myth TV, but that's something different. That's a whole different thing.
Well, you can probably subscribe to your Myth TV recordings with Chipotter if you set it up correctly, which is also a use case that some people do, I think. What else? I listened to How Stuff Works some time ago, which is kind of an entertaining show. There is some NPR podcasts. For example, there's Planet Money. There's Radiolab. Radiolab is really good.
Oh, I love Radiolab. Sorry, I had to jump in and say that. I do love Radiolab. Not as much as I love all the Twitch shows, I should just say.
There's a huge demand for this. I mean, I had a 3-hour commute on the way home last night. It was just awful. There was accidents everywhere for some reason. And it just took forever to get home. And I went through an entire list. I went through like 4 or 5 different podcasts, and thank goodness I had them, because if I was on the radio here in the States with NPR, I would have actually gone through all of of the NPR, whatever it was, All Things Considered, and then start it over again because it loops after 2 hours, you know. So thank goodness I had this podcast, and I think podcasts are great, especially for commuters. At least for me right now, it's real lifesaver. So I'm just kind of curious. First of all, I think everything is licensed. I saw on the website everything's licensed under GPL3. Is that correct?
Yeah. Although for new code that we're doing for Jupyter 4, I tried to put all my contributions under ISC license, which is like a two-clause BSD license, just because I want to make sure that other people who want to maybe write a podcast client that maybe interfaces with Jupyter.net actually can do that, and they don't have to care about things like the GPL3 restrictions. So it is more free in some sense. Some people might say that it's not as free as the GPL, but I like to give users of the library, especially things like the podcast parser library, the freedom to also do closed source development. And because it's Python, it's really hard to do really closed source development. But if you want to do that, if they don't want to be locked into the GPL3, they can do that with the podcast parser library, for example.
Hmm. So how's that going to work? Is it so those are licensed separately, or will it be under a dual license scenario?
So all the new code, it's under the ISC license. And I mean, if you combine the ISC license with GPL3 code, then obviously you can also use it totally under GPL3 license.
Hmm. Interesting. So what are you working on right now? What's kind of coming up? What can people expect to see? I'm really interested in this, the online stuff. By the way, I did finally get the client running and was watching some listening to Linux Outlaws and watching some TED Talks.
Yay.
Just to test it all out. Yeah, so, you know, just to make sure everything's working. And it works great. It just, you know, pops out and uses your whatever your default audio or video player is. That's kind of curious, too. Any thoughts to actually adding in, you know, building in the player functionality into the client?
Yeah, so we do that for a mobile app, for a mobile version. For example, on the N9, we have that. So on the N9, you don't use the media player that's built in there, but we actually play it inside Jupyter because that gives us the ability to actually get the playback position that you stopped and resume. So that's also something that on Linux, on the Linux desktop, you would have to use a special application that can talk to Dbus to Jupyter to report the playback position. So right. If you're using, for example, Windows and VLC or something to play it, we actually can't retrieve the playback position from VLC. So you don't get the position syncing support there.
Yeah, that's kind of, you know, when we were talking before about how you were reporting back the positioning, I thought, how are they getting this out of VLC? Because I don't know how that would work. But it kind of makes sense, you know, at some point to maybe build in. I wonder if you could build in VLC or something like that that's cross-platform into the back end of this to make it easy for the desktop. Anyway, too many things to think about. And it did come up, by the way, when I installed it and asked me, do you want to import your subscribed podcasts from gpodder.net? That was one of the options that it comes up with on startup. So that was really cool. Anyway, getting back to my original question, what's coming up? What's next? What are you working on for? What can users expect to see in the upcoming versions?
Yeah, so for the desktop, it will be mostly the same. We'll probably continue to do Jupyter 3. That means GTK2 and all the things that you have right now, because that's very stable and it's very feature-rich. You have all kinds of extensions that work. For mobile, we are going with Qt5 and QML. So that's called Jupyter 4. And that's actually a part where we have the core separated from all the different UIs. So the core should be very small, and actually is very small already. It's Python 3 only. So it might not work on all systems, but I think Python 3 is the future as well as... can you still hear me?
Yeah, we're still here. Okay. We're intently listening, don't worry.
Okay. where were I? Yeah, so Jupyter 4 is coming up, and I'm going to try to see how many platforms we can actually reach with Qt5 and Python 3. I had some prototype working on Android, so maybe that's one of the possibilities there, porting Jupyter to Android, as well as doing all the other platforms that are supported by Qt5, for example, BlackBerry 10, Sailfish OS, and Ubuntu Phone.
I'm kind of curious why BlackBerry 10? I mean, why BlackBerry? Is that seems to be losing... popularity and market share so rapidly at this point. It's like someone dropped it off a cliff. Is that, do you have a lot of demand for that? Are users asking for that? Or is it just user driven or community driven development that's saying, hey, I love BlackBerry 10 and I have some spare time, I'll port this for you?
It's actually because they do support Qt and Qt 5 very well. So from a technical point of view, it's just very easy to port. So we can actually reuse most of the QML stuff there. And it does have Python 3 installed. I'm not sure if that's official, but if you look into the file system, you can find Python 3 in there. So it's just a matter of being really easy to port to BlackBerry 10.
Yeah. And how big is the community at this point? I noticed when I went to download, it looks like there's a number of people that are at least working on the ports. There's someone, for example, that does the Windows port and a couple of the other ports. How big is the community? How many people are actually in coding or working on translations or documentation or anything like that?
I don't really know because it's changing all the time. So, I mean, I do the German translation and the English source strings, if you want. And there are many other people doing translations for kinds of different languages. As I said, we have some people maintaining different parts. And I would say the core team is like 5 people or something like that. And then there's lots and lots of people around that contribute every now and then.
Mm-hmm. And what are you looking for in terms of help right now? I mean, I know you said the Android port would be, it sounds like that might be the place where you might be able to use the most help. But I don't know. You tell me, what if you're looking for help, what would it be?
Well, for Jupyter 4, we could use somebody who is doing a GTK 3 UI for Jupyter so that it integrates really well into a GNOME 3-based desktop. Because right now, I mean, that's not really my focus because I tried to make it work on mobile devices with QML at this point. So that's something that we could use help with. Obviously, translations into all kinds of languages. Yeah, of course, the web service. Make sure that you can actually report different kinds of problems with web service. For example, if there are duplicate feeds, you can actually report it on Jupyter.net and make sure that we actually merge that on the server side. So, for example, if you have two different feed URLs for the Floss Weekly podcast, we actually do that merging on the server side so that people who subscribe to, for example, the video feed actually can be have their episode statistics combined with just the audio feed. So that's something that we do. And that's usually based on community contributions there, people reporting that to us.
You said GTK3. How well does this work with the Unity interface?
That actually works well with the current Jupyter 3 version, where we have some extensions that you just toggle on and off. And that works really well with Unity. So we have the download progress being reported in the Unity doc. As well as have the app indicator in the top right corner of the screen. So that's something that you have to toggle on, but it integrates nicely, at least with the current versions of Ubuntu that I've tried.
Yeah. Now, before I turn it back over to Dan to wrap up, I'm just kind of curious. You mentioned in the questions when we sent you out, kind of a form to fill out for us that we always do where you get to, like, here's some things I'd like to talk about. One of the things you said was Pi other side. What is that?
Yeah, so if you want to do Qt 5 or Qt 4 with Python, what you actually need is have some kind of bridge. And just like with PyGDK is used to combine Python with the GDK world, you need something to combine Python with the Qt world. Previously with Qt 4, you could do that with PySide, for example, which is an LGBelt binding between Qt and Python. And there's also PyQt, which is a GPL licensed binding. And while you can use that, PyQt, I mean, you can use that to communicate between Qt and Python. It's actually not that efficient. So what I came up with was a really, really small library that allows you to do QML code and inside your QML code, interface with Python code. So if you're doing Qt UIs, not with Qt widgets like the classic user interface that you do on the web. What you usually want to do is use QML and use PyOtherSide to communicate with a Python backend. And that actually is something that we are using in Jupyter 4.
Hmm. Excellent. So that's a new technology that you're bringing in. It sounds very cool. Is there anything that you want to talk about to do with Jupyter or anything else that you do that we haven't mentioned so far? Because I just want to make sure we don't miss anything.
Yeah, I think we've covered most of the stuff for JupyterR. Not sure if you have any more questions.
Well, I was going to ask you, because I happen to know that you're also a games developer, when you're not developing JPodder and other things. I'm always curious about how games, and being a Linux user myself, I mean, the Linux gaming kind of world changed a little bit now. But I'm imagining, as a games developer, you're still largely working on Windows. Is that true?
No, actually, I'm working also on Linux. I mean, I don't even have a Windows installation right now to work on that. And for things like mobile games, you can actually do very well with Linux. So it's, I mean, even for small hobby projects like games that I do, you don't really need that much power. So a normal Linux machine is just fine and works just as well for that.
Okay. And way, way, way off the subject of the of JPodder and so on, I'm sure most people have seen that Steam... the Steam distribution platform from Valve is now on Linux, and they're pushing it, and they're coming out with this thing called, they're calling Steam OS, which effectively is Ubuntu rebadged, if I've got that right, and Steam boxes and stuff. Do you think that will affect the kind of the games development market a lot in future for guys like yourself?
For me personally, probably not, but I think it's good that there's now a player who makes sure that we have big games working on Linux, and it might also help the driver story on desktop Linux, because now there's a real good reason to make sure that graphics drivers work on Linux very well, so that these games run.
Yeah, on the Steam box and so on. Yeah, I was thinking about that myself. I'm not a Steam user, so I haven't really gone into it yet, but everybody I know who's into gaming is really excited about gaming and Linux, I should say, is really excited about Steam coming to Linux. Okay, then. So I need to ask you, Randall's not here, but the spirit of Randall is around always. And I need to ask you his favorite questions. So what's your favorite text editor to use when you're editing stuff?
Vim. I use Vim. I really like it.
See, I love Vim as well, but Randall's not a Vim fan. He's an Emacs fan. And I should just say, other editors are available for somebody writes in and says, hey, what about like Nano? Or Nano's cool as well, by the way, or Joe and all these other things. And also, what's your favorite scripting language? I think I might know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. What's your favorite scripting language?
It's probably Python 3 at this point.
Okay, interesting that you say Python 3 specifically as well. And you mentioned about looking forward to, you know, encouraging people to use Python 3 for any Python project, especially new ones that they're using right now. How does that affect support, though? Because Python 3 is not 100% supported, I don't believe, across, you know, many platforms and devices and stuff. Do you think that's it's ready for that kind of thing, or do you think it'll take another year or so before we get the full support?
Well, I think it's ready right now. The problem is sometimes there are tutorials on the web that are still Python 2 focused. So if people start out with these tutorials and they try it on Python 3, they might be confused that some things don't work because the syntax has slightly changed. As far as I know, all the platforms usually support Python 3 well. The only problem that was a problem 1 or 2 years ago was that some of the big libraries that, for example, Django, actually didn't support Python 3 back then. So that was a big reason for some of the people to not switch to Python 3. And it was actually one of the reasons that we didn't have support for that in JPodder for quite some time. But now that we have JPodder 4 with PyAdaSight, we can actually focus on making sure that all the libraries that people use, or that in our case we use, work with Python 3, and then there's no real reason to stick with Python 2. So even with PyAdaSight, we really try to make sure that only Python 3 is well supported to give another incentive to users to just switch to Python 3 at this point.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're kind of using the stick a little bit as well as the carrot to force people to kind of do that. That is very interesting. Is there anything else you want to mention? We mentioned that before. Anything coming up that you want to tell us about or anything else?
No, if people are interested in testing JPodder 4, with the QML UI on, for example, Android, they should just join the mailing list and get involved there, try to see how easy we can make it to get people to run JPodder 4 on Android.
Yeah, and jpodder.org is the website. If you want to find out more, there'll be links in the show notes for this show, of course, at twit.tv. But if you want to find out more, jpodder.org, and if you want to use the web service, that's jpodder.net. Is that right? Anywhere else people should go to find out more?
I tried to collect all the links on jpodder.org. So if you go there, there will be a link to the Bugzilla where you can look, for example, for tasks that you might want to take on. There's also a help section where you can get to the mailing list. We also have a wiki, which includes information such as documentation for a web service. So if you go to cheapwater.org, you should find all the things in there.
Excellent. And if people want to find out more about what you're up to, it's thp.io, I believe, is the website. Where's .io the TLD for? I'm kind of interested because that's quite a cool...
I think it's the Indian Ocean something something.
Okay.
It was one of the few domains that still were available with THP.
Ah, okay. I thought you were just being clever with the .io because it works well. It sounds good.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, it's very cool. Okay, thank you, Thomas, for coming on and talking to us all the way from Vienna. It's been a pleasure, and I'm really excited about gpodder.net and all these other things. We encourage people to go and have a look at them. So thank you very much for talking to us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, that was Thomas Pearl, who is the lead developer of gpodder, which is a podcast client we've just been talking about. So, Aaron, what did you think?
Well, I think it's great. I mean, I've used it before, so you know, I'm somewhat familiar with it, but I did not know about gpodder.net, which I think is really cool, especially for me. I know it's, you know, self-serving, but you know, the ability to track for podcasters to track where people are watching, how much they're watching, or maybe they replayed this part five times because it was really funny. I don't know if it gets that detailed, but you know, I think that part of it is really, really cool, and could be developed into maybe the commercial end of this service. Is something that we didn't really talk that much about is how do you monetize this, right? But you know, that could be one way to do it, is to collect that information and, at least for Linux podcasters, because it seems like that's where the audience is, be able to provide that information back for a small fee. I think would be, you know, at least a start or some way to take what you have, the data you have, and turn it into a you know, somewhat of a way to support the overall development effort going forward. You know, there's also something that we didn't get to because we're just out of time, but I wanted to point out is that there are extensions for this in the Windows, some really cool extensions. You can convert things into OGG files. You can do post editing, encoding if you want to convert it from maybe an MP3 or MP4, whatever it downloaded into a more open format. You can do that automatically. There's some things in here like streaming to Sonos. That was the other one. If you have a Sonos audio system, you could stream directly to Sonos with one of the extensions that they have for this. So some really cool stuff. If you haven't checked out gpodder and you're looking for especially a desktop podcast app, I would highly recommend checking it out because it just works great.
Yeah, and the big thing for me was the syncing of shows. So, you know, being able to play 20 minutes of a show on one device and then play it on another, because that's something I could really use, because I've got my phone, I've got my tablet, I've got my computer, I've got other things going on, and that's always a nightmare. I have to find where I was in the podcast.
Right, right. And there are other utilities. I mean, I use Pocket Cast right now, and I've used Dog Catcher in the back in previously, but you know, I really like it. But I think there's room for especially the additional features that gpodder has to offer. So I really hope that they are able to port this over to Android and iOS. I think that would be a nice addition to the apps that are already existing on those platforms.
Yeah, and we seem to keep talking about it. One of the first things we mentioned was the Android version. Is there an Android version? So I guess if you're listening to this and you think, oh, I like this, but I wish there was an Android version, much like us, we all need to kind of get off our backsides and go and help them make one, I suppose.
There you go. That's the way.
That's the key to it. That's the message. I had to whip a little message in there for you. we should talk about what's coming up on Floss Weekly in future weeks. I'm not sure how long Randall is away for, but we have next week, we have Dave Neary coming on, who is a Red Hat developer, and he's going to be coming on to talk about OpenStack, which I'm sure most people have heard of listening to this show, very technical audience, but basically the stack that people are building a lot of their cloud stuff on now. So you've got KVM, kernel virtualization, all these other layers and stuff, and Red Hat really into that, along with other companies, obviously loads of other companies. But Dave Neary from Red Hat is going to be coming on to talk about that with Aaron and Gareth, I believe. And then following that, we've got a project called Crossroads at crossroads.io. Again, they've got that same .io TLD there, and I'm just filling for time because I realize I've got no idea what Crossroads is, so I'm just trying to look it up as we go.
I don't either, so sorry, I can't help you out with that one. I know what Crossroads, the networking equipment is.
But... here we go. Crossroads.io, here we go. So, yeah, it says it is Lego bricks for building scalable and high-performance distributed applications. I'm thinking it's not literally Lego bricks. I'm thinking they're using that as... Yeah, so it's for it says it's what BSD sockets might have looked like if they were designed for today's requirements. So there you go. So find out more. You can always tune in to find out more next week. That's the key to that one. And then the following week on the 27th of November, we've got no guest in at the moment, but hopefully we'll have that show filled by then. Following week, we're going to be joined by I'm going to say this name really badly wrong. I apologize, Carlos Puchol, I think it is. Apologies, Carlos, if I've butchered your name, and hopefully I haven't, because he's going to be coming on to talk about a project called Amahi with Aaron and myself. So maybe he can tell us if we've got his name wrong. Amahi is a home media server. Apparently, it's kind of a one-stop solution to, you install it on a server and then you use it for streaming your media and stuff around your home or presumably wherever you want. So that sounds quite interesting. And there are, of course, more guests coming up in the lead up to Christmas. Randall will be back then. And we should mention, if there's a project that you know of, an open source project that you think they should really be on Floss Weekly, I want to hear more about that, then what you need to do is contact the project leader. And if you can, have them contact us. It sounds a little bit convoluted, but it really is the best way to do it. If you can have them contact us by emailing Randall at his address is merlin@stonehenge.com. That's Merlin, as in the wizard, @stonehenge.com. And they can jump to the top of the list. That's the fastest way to get to the top of the list. And we've got more great guests coming up. You can actually find the spreadsheet, which I'm looking at right now. It's public. It's on Google Docs. You can look at it yourself and see who we've got coming up. If you go to twit.tv/flossweekly, you'll find more information there. There's an IRC chat going along as we do the show. So if you want to get in there, you want to ask questions, you want to tell us what you think about the current project, you can do. You can find that as well. It's Twit Live is the name of the room. And there's more information, again, at twit.tv on how to get into that. Come along and join us for a broadcast and ask us some questions and stuff. So I've mentioned at the start of the show, actually, I've been working on a Raspberry Pi project. If you want to find out more about what I'm up to, I mean, you might do, you might not, that's fine. You can always find me at danlynch.org, and you can find out other podcasts and stuff that I'm on, and find out what I've been up to with the Raspberry Pi. So, Aaron, where can people find you and what you've been up to?
You can always go find me at +AaronNewcomb, which is my address on Google Plus. That's where I hang out most of the time. Definitely go check me out there. If you'd rather, you can follow me on Twitter or Facebook, because all my stuff gets rebroadcasted to those two networks as well. So whatever your pick your poison, whatever your preference. I also co-host occasional co-host, I like to call myself, a number of other podcasts on the Twit network. So you can usually find me if you do a search on All About Android or This Week in Google. TNT, which is coming up if you're watching live shortly after this. I've been on there a few times. So anyway, I stand in, as I like to say, for anytime they need a guest host over there in the Brick House. I'd love to join the Twit crew. Everybody's so nice, all the producers, especially our producer, John. He's awesome. Like to get that in there because maybe he'll... we should say that. Otherwise, we're in big trouble. We could be. So anyway, find me on the Twit network or over on Google Plus.
Excellent. And don't forget, you can always find us on the Twit network, of course. If you go to twit.tv, you'll find us there, where you can find the notes for this show and find links to all the projects and find other great shows as well. So I think that's going to do us for this week. So thank you very much for joining us. Thank you, Aaron, for coming on and joining me as well. It was great fun, as always.
Anytime.
No problem. And we'll catch you next time for another Floss Weekly.